KRWM, HD3, Bremerton, Seattle.
And on TuneIn.com, Hing.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Coming up is the Linda Christensen Show, where your host explores the depth of spirituality and the frontiers of thought to expand your mind and nurture your soul. Now here's your host, Dr. Linda.
Well, good evening there, Contact Talk Radio listeners. Welcome once again to my show here. I am your host, as always, Linda Christensen. And tonight, we want to explore the whole experience and teachings and wisdom of shamanism. And as you probably know, I teach in comparative religion, and I really do see shamanism as being, of course, the origin, the font, the source, really, of all the religious traditions, ultimately. And the world religions that we have are quite the institutionalized forms that have come out of the whole shamanic experience of being able to connect with the realm, the world of the gods, the world of spirits, the world of soul. And in the world religions, that has become so institutionalized, where this wisdom then gets put down in a text and it becomes something quite static and frozen. And we've lost, I think, that sort of more dynamic connection with the spiritual domain, the realm of soul, as a result of that. And there obviously is quite an interest these days in shamanism and many attempts at reinventing it, bringing it again, making it accessible to the modern world and for us urbanites. And indeed, that is a good thing. I really do think we need the wisdom of shamanism. And one thing that has so intrigued me is the whole tradition that revolves around soul loss, soul retrieval. This is something that seems to me is quite neglected, obviously, in mainstream psychology and therapy. And this is an area that we really could use guidance and some useful understanding here in this domain. And so I have brought on as my guest here tonight someone who's quite the expert in these things. Our guest tonight is Christina Pratt. She's the founder of the Last Mask Center for Shamanic Healing, which she founded first on the East Coast in Manhattan and then operated it both on the East and West Coast and has now more recently settled in Portland, Oregon. She also is the author of the Encyclopedia of Shamanism, a 2-volume work. I think she also runs her own radio show dealing with shamanic topics and interviewing various people in this arena. And so I am pleased to have her as my guest tonight, Christina Pratt. Welcome to my show.
Well, thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Yes, it's wonderful. Now, listen, you've trained quite extensively in this whole arena of shamanism. Could you just give us a bit of a rundown as to how you got into this and some of the training you underwent? Because I know you've studied under various shamans and various traditions. And just to introduce yourself a bit for us.
Well, for me, my shamanic initiation was unintentional and spontaneous. It happened while I was a modern dancer in New York. And as a result of that experience, I started actually noticing things about shamanism. So I didn't really understand the experience that had happened to me. I didn't have a way to put it into context, but it did start bringing the things I needed to find across my path. I guess I would say it that way. And one of the first things that I stumbled over was an article interviewing Sandra Ingerman, this is 20 years ago. So Sandra Ingerman had just recently published the book Soul Retrieval. And it was an interview of Sandy talking about soul loss and soul retrieval. And having had this profound life-changing experience, I read this article and I had this moment I have never had since, where it felt like I was remembering the thing you have to forget to get born about why you're here. And so I had this well, it was a profound sort of mystical experience moment of it all coming together. And I thought, oh, my God, I just remembered that thing I was supposed to forget. This is why I'm here. So for me, I didn't pursue trying to become a shaman. For me, it was totally focused on learning to do soul retrieval work, because that had been the experience that called me, was this work. And I didn't understand that it had this whole, all this baggage around it called shamanism. I just wanted to do soul retrieval.
Right.
And so I called up the organization that Sandy was teaching for at the time, which is the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, founded by Michael Horner, and asked, you know, what do I have to do to learn to do this? And I was happy to do anything. And, you know, and so I went through their a couple levels of training to then learn how to do the soul retrieval work. And so for me, it was very focused around soul retrieval itself. And it's only then through the relationship with spirit, you know, as you were talking about the world religion and how they evolved out of shamanism, you know, the fundamental key in shamanism is direct revelation, is your direct connection with spirit through shamanic practices. It's not just random, spontaneous, you know, good insight. It's a practice of connecting in with spirit and asking questions and getting answers that you then apply to life. So it's very practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I had learned to do that, then the next thing was learning to work with spirit, but then spirit begins to work with you. And so this whole larger agenda emerged that was much bigger than my little plan to go just learn how to do soul retrievals and just, you know, be in a cave somewhere and just have people come and get soul retrievals. So this bigger story emerged about what does it mean to be a shaman in the past? What does it mean to be a shaman now? And so in many ways, writing the encyclopedia helped me put that bigger picture in the context of shamanism historically, cross-culturally. You know, what am I doing? Who are my ancestors? Why am I doing this? You know, how does this all fit into a bigger picture? Because it really was naive to think I was going to just practice soul retrieval in a vacuum. So for me, that is the real difference in shamanic work, other than mostly our religious practices, is that you are really cultivating a long-term working relationship with spirit that is your direct contact. You know, for better or for worse, you're the one who's interpreting the message, and you're the one who's going after the message and asking the questions and having this active, everyday, long-term relationship with the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not asking anyone to do that for you, to be the intermediary. Not that you wouldn't listen to the great writings and the great teachings of all the humanities teachers, but the bottom line is, what are my helping spirits guiding me to do? Why am I here in this life? And how do they support me in doing that?
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's the distinction, is that the responsibility is placed back on my shoulders. It's not on some intermediary's shoulders to define this for me and help me figure that out. You know, I need to figure it out. So for me, I started with a couple years of training with the Foundation for Shamanic Studies and started practicing. And then my real training started because I got a job at the Omega Institute over the summer. And for those of you that don't know, Omega is like the mothership of all retreat centers in America. And so we had, I don't know, 4 to 8 conferences going every weekend and every week for, at that time, 4 months solid. Now it's like 6 months solid. And so I was on call, and so I had an experience most contemporary practitioners don't get, which is to be on call 24/7, which is actually what it's like to be the shaman in the village.
Mm.
And most of us don't have that experience because we're contemporary practitioners. We schedule appointments. We work however much we want to work. We don't have that experience of being there for the people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so those 2 years is where I really believe I learned to practice. Was doing it, and I learned it from the people who were willing to come to me as clients and experience the shamanic healing. And the spirits taught me what to do as people came to me with problems no one had trained me to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the humans had given me the techniques to use, but had not really begun to prepare me for what would come through my door.
Mm-hmm.
But the spirits were there, and spirits is a terrible word to to use because it conjures, like, you know, dead Aunt Mabel.
Yeah.
And really, it's just the struggle with English and how it's not really a great word to talk about, you know, love and sex and spirit and religion, because it just doesn't have the words for it. And and so what we're really talking about are energies that have no form, that show up every day in your work group, just like people, but they don't have form. You know, so this isn't random. So it's a set of beings that simply don't have form, that are the exact same beings that show up when I go to work. That's who's there. That's my work group, or I'm their work group, or if you want to think about that. But it's really about developing this long-term relationship and then using it. Okay, so anyway, so worked at the Omega Institute for a couple summers and really learned how to be a practitioner. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, I really saw, okay, these are all the questions that nobody has answered for me. And so really what I saw in that was what I didn't know. And then I started working on the encyclopedia and got a lot of questions answered historically. And then the question is, well, what does that mean for me today? And so for me, the 6 years researching and writing the encyclopedia was a huge teacher as well, and helped me, you know, because I'm just a little random white girl from Oregon, right? I'm not claiming any, you know, indigenous lineage or anything like that. What the hell was I doing, right? And so to research the world, I mean, I think shamanism is a gift to humanity. And that it is here for all of us. And so it put me in that context. So my sense when I work with my people is my people are humanity. I don't, you know, and so I'm not a village shaman in a sense anymore. It's much more global than that. So anyway, so while I was working on the encyclopedia and after, I visited very slowly because I didn't make a whole lot of money, very slowly visited different practitioners in different parts of the world who were exceedingly good at aspects of shamanism I didn't really understand. And I wanted to watch people in their environment doing it so I could come to understand the bigger picture and what questions should I be asking my helping spirits to understand how to do it back home with my people. So that evolved over the years. And then within that, I was also teaching. And so then the helping spirits are also teaching me through the teaching shamanic practices. And so it's been quite an education over many, many years. And it's always happening because the more you learn about shamanism, the more you know you don't know. You just get better able at asking better questions.
Wow.
But it's huge. I mean, it's a huge path of mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And no one should ever work with a shaman who doesn't perceive of it that way. Anyone who thinks they've got it wired, run the other way. They don't get it, get how big it is.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's one thing I sometimes wonder about, you know, here and there where you run into some people and, you know, they might do a weekend workshop and then set themselves up with a shingle, you know, a shamanic practitioner. And I don't know.
You know.
There's quite a bit of that out there, I think, and I see that a lot. Or they do a workshop one weekend on dealing with angels, and now they're, you know, an expert on angelic divination or who knows what.
Yeah. I always tell people that if you do want to look for a shaman, ask the people that are in your area about their initiation. And now they may not want to tell you because it can be a very private experience, but the fact that they have that private experience, that they will tell you, I'm sorry, I can't tell you the details of it, but, you know, this happened for me 15 years ago, that's a good answer. Mm-hmm. But someone who just says, oh, well, I just studied 3 years with so-and-so, that's not a good answer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean anything necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like academia where you get credit for showing up. You know, in shamanism, you have to actually produce something with what you've learned or it doesn't count.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was merit-based.
Yeah. Now, just a little note here. So in terms of initiation, I know that in classic traditional shamanism, that was always sort of maintained as you would get initiated. It's all more like, as you said, the spirits would pick you instead of you choosing shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
That's often the case, and there usually would be some profound initiatory experiences involved. And so it sounds as though you feel that definitely that is still the case and something that is really basically required.
Well, it's one of the things that makes me unpopular with my peers.
Mm.
But I really do believe that that does make the difference between the people that really understand shamanism and are capable of, you know, shamanism has never gone away on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been here, and mm-hmm. it's always in part staying the same and in part shifting. So the functions are staying the same, but the form is shifting. So the mm-hmm. function of soul retrieval stays the same. But some of how we do that might shift to address the time,
mm-hmm.
right? But
mm-hmm.
the function still needs to happen because people still experience soul loss. So what I'm really interested in is the practitioners that are initiated and are able to shift the forms in a way that the functions still work versus, and this is so American, dumbing it down so everybody's comfortable with it.
Uh-huh,
you know,
yes.
Which is what Americans have done with yoga. They've done it with Qigong and Tai Chi. They've done it with all of these great practices we've found from all over the world. We bring it here and take out all the hard parts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would force us to look at ourselves
mm-hmm.
and force us to acknowledge our own soul woundedness and attend to that versus, you know, going for the power yoga and the power this and the power that. And you know, so this is what we have done with everything that we've brought over, and we've done it also with shamanism. And so that's what I'm really interested in, is the people that have had these profound, life-changing experiences and have left their child self behind and are moving in spiritual maturity in this work. And those are the people you want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people may or may not get there, but you don't need to be the person that they're guinea-pigging on.
Right. Oh no, this is wonderful. So to go, move on to exactly on soul loss and soul retrieval, how do you define soul loss, and how does it show up in a person's life, and how do you go about defining it? Say, you know, for people who have never been exposed to even this concept, how would you describe it, and how do you assess when that shows up in someone's life?
So, like, when I'm at a cocktail party,
oh, yeah.
you know, what uh-huh. I say to people is, well, you know that feeling you have where you've never been the same since? Do you have any of those experiences in life? And everybody does. You know, they had a car accident, they moved, they had a breakup. You know, those things in life where we look back to that point and we go, God, I have never been the same since whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my third grade teacher got married and moved away. And then we had that horrible old hag for the rest of the year. You know, I mean, these these stories from our life where we know we've never been the same since. In psychology, it's a metaphor. And in shamanism, it's real. You really haven't been the same since because some part of yourself was so profoundly shaken by that event that it remains back there trying to resolve it while the rest of you was able to numb out and go forward and pretend like it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, now that's the simplistic answer, the simplistic, you know, cocktail party answer, so I don't make people too nervous. But the reality from a shamanic perspective is that the soul, that we can experience soul loss when we feel we're going to die spiritually, mentally, emotionally, or physically. So the obvious soul loss comes with things that are physically threatening, like a car wreck, like physical abuse, like getting mugged, you know, these kinds of things where we feel that our physical life is being threatened.
Mm-hmm.
However, in shamanism, because we're always looking at the soul and its experience here in the physical body and how those things are working together, that you can also experience those moments. I remember, for me, it was third grade. Oh, my God, if I have to suffer through this teacher one more day, I'm going to die. Or if I have to suffer through these bullies one more day, if I have to suffer through my sister one more day, I'm going to die. You know, these feelings that there's this emotional pain that is so profoundly grating against where our soul is trying to go, that we just, it's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. And we just have to let go of that part of ourselves so we can numb out about that and move on. And this can happen also around our beliefs and ideas about the world. I mean, back to religion, I can't tell you how many kids I have found in church. Now, these are soul part kids. These are not the person. The person's a grown-up now. But they're struggling with feeling abandoned by God or just being mad at God or not being able to find a spiritual life or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that part of themselves that as a child had a great relationship with God by whatever way their family defined God, you know, whether whoever, doesn't matter. They knew who God, kids know who God is, right? They're having a great relationship. They're talking all the time. Life is good. And it's that day in church where they finally get that those people in church are telling them they can't talk directly to God. Like only the priest or the rabbi or the whoever gets to talk to God. And they're, and it's just this moment of profound confusion. And the part of ourself whose job it is to stay connected to that source energy has to choose. Do I stay connected? Or do I go with this person that can't talk to me anymore? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the kid wants to do the right thing to stay with the family that's going to love them and feed them. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to belittle our childhood, but that is really powerful in childhood, is who is going to love us and who's going to take care of us.
That's right.
And we want desperately to fit in, and we just got told, if I keep talking to God, I'm bad. So what do I do? Well, the part whose job it is to keep talking to God is going to stay right there and talk to God. And you're going to go off and lose your connection with the source and go fit in with the family where they're going to love you and take care of you, but you just lost your own innate connection to God. I find tons of soul parts in church because of that moment of that profound confusion and betrayal. All
right.
I find 15-year-old boys stoned out of their minds in the basement playing video games because there isn't anyone in their life that can initiate them into manhood.
Wow.
I mean, our soul knows what it needs. And we look around in this contemporary world, and there are many things that are not physically threatening, but are very spiritually threatening for our health and well-being as a as an ensouled person. Mm-hmm. And we look around this contemporary world, and it's just crushing. And so these things, these moments in life, can also create soul loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening is the part of ourself who is threatened and troubled by this, stays stuck in that threat and trouble in time, in that moment when we come to that realization. And the rest of us moves on, and now we don't think about it anymore, we don't feel it anymore, we don't worry about it anymore, we just numb out about it, and we move on. And so, in a sense, it's also a coping mechanism.
Right. So how does a person know if they are suffering from a soul loss? I mean, if there is this sort of numbing out, and as you said, you don't think about it, feel it anymore, you know, you've just sort of basically shut it down, then it can be quite deceptive in that you think you're over something, but you're really not.
Right, because if you're really, really good at soul loss, you never even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the telltale signs, because as soon as we lose a part of ourselves, we essentially, sort of functionally speaking, we have a hole in our energy. And human beings are just a big energy bucket, right? And we're supposed to have energy in the bucket. And so we have to contain energy and cultivate energy in our life. Some of that comes in very mundane ways through food. It can come through our spiritual practices. But basically, when we experience something as profound or at the core level as soul loss, then we have a hole in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And that hole is in the bucket every day, all the time. It doesn't come and go on our good days and our bad days. It's just fundamentally there. And so then, no matter what we're doing, we're always leaking energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of us are sort of intuitive enough to try to figure out some sort of behavior to try to plug that hole, because it's also a vulnerability. And so this begins to be the reasons we have challenges with intimacy and connection and commitment and relationship, because we're too busy protecting ourselves because we're vulnerable in a deep, deep spiritual way. And then on top of that, most of us are leaking energy desperately. We're hemorrhaging, many of us. And so we get into addictive behaviors to fill the hole. And, you know, heroin addicts understand it the best. They can tell you the hole they're filling with heroin. I don't know what it is about heroin addicts, but they're really clear. But it's true if we're addicted to sex or working out or work. all mm-hmm. of these things that we do obsessively to try to fix something that is just bottomless. And so in our spirit work or our personal work, if we get to a place of trying to be, you know, self-aware, and it's just an abyss, it's just a hole, it just feels hopeless, it feels utterly insurmountable, you've just walked up to a hole caused by soul loss, that feeling of hopelessness, and that it's just this dark abyss and I can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. That is the feeling of having just walked into your soul loss, mm-hmm. and you're just staring at the hole. And the thing about our soul parts is, we know we're very clever beings, and our soul parts are hiding from us, right? So mm-hmm. we can't go find them. We're the worst person to go look for them, because it's us hiding from us, and so it's like perfectly hidden from us. And that's and also, these are the greatest unresolved issues of our life. Uh-huh. So we're very likely, if we were to stumble on the actual lost soul part, to get stuck in it again, because we're utterly unresolved about these issues.
Uh-huh.
And so the symptoms then of soul loss, other than addiction and chronic behavior patterns we're trying to change, but we can't, I mean, especially when we're doing all the right things to change mm-hmm. them, and we still mm-hmm. can't. So mm-hmm. whenever you have the feeling that the energy you're putting into your healing or your change or your transformation isn't paying off, that's mm-hmm. soul loss.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you have the feeling like your psychiatrist is saying, you know, these drugs should be working for you, but they're not. Whenever the normal treatments, acupuncture, pharmaceuticals, whatever it is, that normally would work, aren't, then mm-hmm. there's a deeper reason. Mm-hmm. The reason the chemicals aren't working is because it's not originally a chemical problem. It's turned into one, but it didn't start there. And so what we're doing when we're going after lost soul parts is going to the source of the problems that have escalated in our life because we've had to adapt to living in this state of soul loss and being in a bucket with holes. And so it's any of these chronic energy problems, all this, it's potentially at the root of chronic fatigue and, you know, all of those vague diagnoses people get because they're exhausted, they're in pain all the time, you know, chronic ick, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. chronic suffering, but nobody really knows why. It's often at the root of depression and many of the things that we're medicating now. These chronic feelings of something other than, I have a soul's purpose and I'm here to live it. Let's go. I mean, mm-hmm. and most Americans don't live from that place, and that's because most Americans have experienced some kind of soul loss. And so it's many people actually feel the emptiness. Many people feel that there's something inside of them that's lost. Some people have this vague memory of a time, and they can't get back to it. That some people really do have a sense of this sort of vagueness of remembering themselves before the loss. Others just feel the adaptation on the other side of the loss, and the chronic behaviors can't change. And then the other thing would just be patterns. The same boss over and over again, job after job. The same partner they're marrying over and over again, and the same problems over and over again, no matter how much therapy, you know, no matter how much change. So that kind of chronic, especially in the face of efforts to change things, is almost a sure sign of some sort of soul loss in that.
Okay.
So that's like everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, boy. I'm starting to feel hopeless here.
No. Because this is the thing about it. When we struggle to find it ourselves through these other modalities that are not shamanic, we can literally spend years and, what, thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. But if you use the right tool, and this is the thing, shamanism is the perfect tool for soul loss. I don't think shamanism is the perfect tool for a lot of energy healing anymore. It used to be, but there's great energy healing forms now.
Right.
So I wouldn't say shamanism is the perfect tool for everything. But it is the perfect tool for soul loss. Because a shaman can go in one session, maybe access more than one part, and just bring them back and give them to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so simple, shamanically. And now when you go to therapy, the part of you that needs to hear the therapy is present. It happens faster, it's more effective, and issues get done. You actually resolve things and have a profound fundamental change in how you orient in life and you move on from things. I mean, isn't that be a relief?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So that's the key thing, is that the part of you isn't there
exactly
to even be present to hear and be engaged in, you know, the corrective behavior or whatever it is.
See, and this is the thing, and this is my little bit my irritation with other practitioners of other modalities who don't, like, loosen the grip and just let people go get their parts back. I don't do therapy with people. I don't want them coming to see me every week. I want to see them once a year, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The issue is, I mean, think about a jigsaw puzzle. If you take one piece out of a jigsaw puzzle, you can pretty much perfectly define what that piece is, the shape, what it looks like, even if you can't find it, because of the rest of the puzzle. Well,
yes,
that's the thing. Everything else is, all these other modalities are happening on the rest of the puzzle. So, of course, you can spend years talking about the part that's missing. It's clear what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you need the part back for a resolution. And so that's my perspective, is every single practitioner in every facet of the medical world should have a good shamanic practitioner they can refer to and know what the symptoms are and just send them out, get their soul parts back, and then go get to work.
Right.
Because then
no,
it will work.
That sounds great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how, what's involved then in soul retrieval? I mean, what is it that you would do? How do you find that lost part? How is it that that is shown to you, or how does that work?
Well,
if you can describe that a bit.
Backing up a little bit, because we can't assume your audience, you know, knows everything about shamanism. So the shamanic trance states are all very function-oriented. And so versus like a meditative trance state where I might want to become one with the universe, and that's the point of that meditation, and I just disperse into the great oneness, and that's the value of it, is that healing that comes from that experience. In a shamanic trance state, I am entering into a world very much like the world we go into when we're dreaming at night. So we don't have a whole lot of control. It's very changeable. But it takes form in some way. So there's a certain amount of story that we can find there, although it's a little confusing like dreams are.
Mm-hmm.
And so in shamanic trance states, we are entering that kind of world where things are taking shape and form like the dream world on purpose with a goal. So in soul retrieval, that's easy. My goal is to find, what parts does this client need to heal at this time? Okay, and actually, I'm not even that specific. I ask, what does this person need to heal? Because it may not be soul parts, but just to simplify this, we'll focus on soul parts. So there are shamanic practices. There are techniques. It's just like a meditation technique or a yoga technique. There's certain things that you need to do to enter into this particular trance state, but in that trance state, you are completely lucid, focused on your task, but open to what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no control over what I find. The only focus or control is the fact that I'm looking and asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
So I might be journeying along would be the language, but that basically means I sense myself moving through vagueness or darkness because none of this matters, right? And then what matters is going to begin to come into focus in a kind of multi-sensory way. And so, for example, I remember the first time that I kind of materialized in the soul part of a client who, the soul part was a young child. The client was, you know, middle-aged, but the soul part was a child, like 6 or 7. And I was actually materializing inside the part, which doesn't always happen. And the part was being thrown against the wall by the father and then hit in the head. And so I experienced that a few times because, of course, that's a very disorienting experience to be thrown against the wall and hit in the head. And so this kind of repeated a few times so I could understand who was this about and what was going on. And once I figured that out, I stepped out of the soul part, the little six-year-old kid, to understand what was going on. And then I just began to talk to the kid and say, so would you like to leave? I mean, in that situation, that's pretty easy sell. Like, you want to get the hell out of there because dad's. But maybe not. Maybe that kid's there because if dad's beating me up, he's not beating up my sibling or my mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a negotiation that has to happen. And you can't. And to do this well, you cannot make any assumptions other than the fact that ultimately it is better for the part to be back with the person that they are now in present time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a negotiation that occurs. So I would basically... And one of the great leverages in the negotiation is telling the kid, you know, you're a grown up now. You don't have to put up with any of this. And they're like, great, get me out of here. And that's the thing, is these soul parts split off so that the rest survive. And so I'm coming in, you know, in service of the surviving self, saying, look, you're a grown-up. You don't have to put up with this anymore. Why don't we leave this and you can deal with things with your grown-up, with who you are in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and since I'm dealing with people who grew up in mostly in contemporary America, not shamanic cultures, I do it more like, hi, I'm from the future. I mean, just like it's some movie or something. Yeah. Hi, I'm from the future. Your future self is 45 now. She really needs you to come back. So let's go. And so there's a negotiation, and then the difference between shamanism now and just channeling, because someone could channel that information for somebody, could, you know, mediumship it to somebody. Mm-hmm. My job now is to energetically grab that part so that I can move them from wherever it is that they are. I mean, they're totally outside of the time you and I are in, mm-hmm. or my client and I are in, and bring them with me back into present time. And so the way that we do that, and this is the traditional part, this hasn't changed ever. This is still the way they did soul retrievals back a gajillion years ago, is you draw the soul part into your heart. Mm-hmm. So you can move it from wherever it is back to now. Mm-hmm. Because the thing that is really beautiful about shamanism that I've discovered over the years is the human heart is exactly the same no matter what realm you're in.
Hmm.
It is an amazing thing, the human heart. Hmm. And so no matter what realm I'm in, no matter what I may have transformed into to be able to be in that realm, no matter what is going on in the journey, that my heart will be the same no matter how many transitions we have to go from wherever we are back to where the present time.
Wow, that is interesting, isn't it? So almost it seems as that the heart is really the essence.
Absolutely.
Of soul, of being, of you know, persona, energy, whatever.
Yeah, and in shamanic teachings we really teach that true power is mediated through the heart. Anything mm-hmm. not mediated through the heart is some abuse of power.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so the soul part's in the heart, and then I would, if I'm doing it long distance, then I would journey to wherever the person actually is. So if my client is in New Jersey, then I would journey to wherever they are in New Jersey and return the energy to their body. Now, if the person were lying right next to me, I would cup my hands and blow the energy into their heart and into the top of their head. So it's not a hands-on modality. That's as close as it gets to hands-on. Mm. So in the journey, if I'm doing it long distance, I do the same thing, but it's happening in the journey. So I'm still blowing it into their heart and into the top of their head.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very, as simplistic as it is, it's very important, because there are moments, I've met people who have had really profound moments of either healing or crisis, actually. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes. And a soul part has returned to them. But because nobody blows it into them, it just hangs out with them, but it never gets back into their energy body.
Oh, really?
It's kind of a fascinating thing. And so that's the easiest kind of soul retrieval to do. You just get to do the blowing. The point is that the energy needs to be transferred from where it is back to the person in present time and put back into their energy body. And then the next thing that I do, which is not part of traditional shamanism, is then to work with the person over the next couple months to integrate that soul part energy into the whole person that they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the reason that I say that's not part of traditional shamanism is traditionally shamanic people would not have waited to get a soul retrieval. Right? You would have gotten it within days or weeks, maybe at most
month
if you had to bring the shaman in from, you know, seven villages over or something.
Right, right.
But you wouldn't adapt to the loss. You would just feel the loss and live with it. It would be identified and acknowledged, and no one would expect you to cope and carry on and pretend nothing happened. I mean, our moments of soul loss are some of those really horrible Thanksgiving stories they tell every year. Oh, you started failing as soon as we moved from Louisiana. You just kept getting D's. You know, I mean, yeah, we love hearing that every year at Thanksgiving. You know, but that was soul loss.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
So, very interesting.
Yeah, and so the energy gets brought back, and that's the most important thing. And then the person in current time, because this may have been decades since this part left, needs to adapt to that energy, or another way to say it would be to unadapt.
Mm-hmm.
So if we go
right.
back to the bucket, there's a hole in the bucket. I've just found the piece that fits in the hole, but that piece has got to get soldered in or it's just going to fall back out again. And so that integration piece is really that place where we make the soul that's in you and the soul part that's come back whole again.
Okay. All right. Now the impression I also get from just things that you said and what you have here is that soul loss is a key factor in how we then often struggle with discovering or knowing what our soul purpose is. Is that true?
Absolutely. And partly, you know, that's also because we live in a culture where parents are exceedingly concerned that we're going to grow up and make a good living.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily concerned that we're going to grow up and do what we came here to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not real focused. We don't start, you know, raising kids. Most of us don't, you know, ask, so what'd you dream about last night? We're like, get out of bed and get to school, you know. We don't cultivate that inner relationship of knowing, of communicating with the soul and knowing why I'm here and feeling the things in life that we feel really passionate about and following those passions, because it's those passions that will lead us to our actual purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
all those little passions that kids have, to a certain extent, if we possibly can, need to be indulged so that they can mm-hmm. feel what they have true passion for and what they don't. And then they really shouldn't be forced to do things they really, really don't have a passion for, because it's just not, you know, like for a kid who's got music as part of their soul's purpose, yeah, okay, get them to practice their piano.
Mm-hmm.
But for a kid that doesn't have music anywhere in their passion field, you know, they really shouldn't be forced to take piano lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And if that little girl really wants to go play baseball, let her play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? I mean, and that's the thing, is that by being allowed to follow our passions as they rise and fall as kids, we know what that feels like to be moved by the things that bring us really to ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And left to our own devices as kids, we do have many, many moments of ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it feels like to begin to follow the passion that shows you this is my soul's purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I was, quote unquote, very consciously living my soul's purpose without being able to tell you what it was, but I could feel it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the thing, is people want it as a job title.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come that way.
Right, yeah.
So
okay.
we can lose the part mm-hmm. of ourselves that knows our soul's purpose. And that makes it very hard to find our soul's purpose. We can lose the part of ourselves that carries the passion because, let's say, we got told as girls our passion was totally inappropriate.
Right.
Or our parents were completely inappropriate sexually, so we shut down our passion. And so now we can't find the passion that guides us to our soul's purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Or for some reason, we were never allowed to act on our desires. And so, mm-hmm. you know, to have a purpose, to feel the passion for that purpose and the desire to bring it out in the world, that these energies are so strong when they're connected to our soul's purpose. But if we never got to feel any of that, or those parts are lost in soul parts, we can't put it together.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. No, and I think it's an epidemic of a loss.
Loss
of soul, loss of passion, loss of purpose. It really is an epidemic out there. And to kind of tie it in with this, how about the other side of the story, which intrigues me? I've came across recently, spirit release therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Is there much in terms of shamanic work that you do in that arena, in terms of sometimes there's an attachment of other, I don't know what you want to call them, entities, energies, whatnot, that really aren't a part of you, that can be creating some havoc for you?
Right. And so basically with shamanic healing, there's the side we've been talking about, which is energy that needs to come back. We were speaking mostly only about soul parts that need to come back, but there are other energies that might need to be returned to someone for their health and well-being. But we've kind of talked about that side of the fence. So the other side of shamanic healing is what energies are present in your energy body that shouldn't be there because they're not healthful for you. And it's actually a whole range. the simplest energy, we would consider that healing a cleansing. And so it would be an energy that is fairly diffuse and can't quite be named, but clearly it's not healthy. And the important thing about all of these energies is they can be externally or internally generated. Okay, so then from cleansing, we would go to something where the technical shamanic term would be an extraction, where the energy is now organizing enough, or is more highly organized, so it's something we would name, like an illness or a tumor, it's localized, some kind of pain or injury to an area, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that, so that now becomes an energy that you can sort of get your hands on, in a sense, and so that's an extraction. And there's a lot of energy and clearing in contemporary life that is not a full-on entity, in a sense. It's not that organized. It's not that complex. But it's the kind of thing someone has a chronic relationship with. So if someone has got soul loss because one of their parents was kind of, you know, excessively angry all the time, the person probably has soul loss around anger, and thus is now a magnet, or another way to say it, has perfect openings then for other people's anger to come in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there's a correlation between what energy can invade our space, basically, and what energy we've already lost. Mm-hmm. So if we had no soul loss, we would be impervious to intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing to understand, is most intrusive energies are not propelled by some deep evil force. They're just vagrant and looking for a warm place to live like everything else. And you've given them that opening. I mean, it's a lot of energies are lazy and opportunistic, and we don't realize the extent to which we give them opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so then we go from cleansing to extraction then to what we would start to call depossession, which is a tricky word to use because of Hollywood, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that's technically what it is, which is an energy that is now organized enough to be something that is essentially has some soul force or some sort of energy that we need to work with. Now, there's old-fashioned depossession, and then there's heart-centered depossession.
Mm-hmm.
And old-fashioned depossession is in the movies. You know, me and my spiritual buddies are bigger than you, get the hell out, kind of forceful. Mm-hmm. And then there's also stories about being beaten, the person being beaten, and you know, it's there. Not very loving, and it's not based on the principle that everything is one. And that is really at the core of shamanic teaching. And so there's a heart-centered perspective now about depossession that really looks at the idea that we have to be with these energies and help to unfold how they got to this place to find out what they truly are and to get them back where they truly belong. And so right now, in contemporary America, the most common, quote-unquote, possessing energy is simply everyday normal dead people who didn't know what to do when they died. They're not demonic. They're not bad. They're not evil. They're not trying to hurt anybody. They're just lost and confused.
Mm-hmm.
And we're warm and beautiful, and they're not anymore. They're dead. You know what I mean? So it's a huge epidemic because we don't deal well with the dead. And so, in a sense, it's our own ancestors that need help, but at the same time, they do intrude into our lives and begin to influence our behavior if we're not strong about our purpose and our energy. And so these energies do need to be released, and I encourage people to look for people that talk about heart-centered depossession.
Mm-hmm.
And some type of work that's really looking, because the other thing is, okay, so I do this big, you know, my spiritual allies are bigger than yours, get out, and I drive the spirit out. Well, it's just going to go jump into somebody else. You know, we need to start cleaning up the mess. And the beauty of the heart-centered process is assuming there is some place this energy belongs in the larger energy of things. And it's our task not only to help the client by removing it, but to help this energy get to its highest state, whatever that is, its true form, and then get it where it needs to go so that it can be back in its right place in the great, you know, cycling of energy of the universe, which I don't presume to completely understand. But when we're doing that work, the spirits will guide us there to where that is.
And so what kind of, how does this attachment of these energies, how does that show up in a person's life? How could someone perhaps detect or suspect, or what sort of signs would there be that this is happening?
Well, for people that actually do energy work themselves, like do a morning meditation or a morning visualization or Qigong or Tai Chi or something, so they have a sense of knowing what their own body feels like normally, then they could feel the intrusion of another energy because it might have an emotional charge to it that's not really how they're feeling at the moment. So why am I suddenly feeling so fat? You know, why, you know, the feeling of being sort of overwhelmed by a kind, by an emotion that doesn't really fit with what's actually going on in your life. But if we don't notice, you know, so for people that don't have a regular energy practice, they're just going about their everyday life, you know, starting out at Starbucks and eating lunch at Subway, you know, they don't know the difference between their energy and a foreign energy. So they may be completely overrun by other energies and having their emotions and their ideas and their thoughts completely played by these other energies as these other entities, for the lack of a better word, are trying to resolve their life in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have a body anymore to do it. I mean, we are so naive about the incredible value of the free will that we have by being in a living body. And once you're dead, you don't have that anymore, and that is a big shock, because all that stuff you left undone in your life, it's still undone, and you can't fix it now, because you do not have the ability to change things. And that is a profound shock to many Americans when they die. And it's a big, like, oh, crap, moment, you know, because suddenly your whole life is there before you, and you can't fix it. Because you're dead. It's really important to fix it before you go. So the way people would feel then would be an inability, again, when we're trying to make changes happen, to sustain the change.
So,
and the other thing is people actually usually feel that it's foreign. They go, it just doesn't feel like me. You know, whenever I'm around this guy, all of a sudden I start acting like this. Or whenever I'm in this situation, you know, this feeling that in some situations they're able to really completely run the show and push the energy away, and then in other situations the energy begins to drive things more. And there's a feeling that it's foreign. Not quite right.
Yeah. Well, very interesting. I could just relay some of my experiences that I've found a lot of these things of what you're talking about. I found them to be true to firsthand experience in my life. And that's just spontaneously without, you know, knowing at times about shamanism or whatnot. It's just directly through experience. And that's why I'm so interested in shamanism. I really find there's so much wisdom here. Christina, we just have 2 minutes left.
Okay.
Do you want to just tell people briefly about your center? And I think, do you also have a radio show, don't you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So just tell us a little bit about, you know, so people will know how to get a hold of you or what you're about or what you all offer.
Well, there's almost 3 years of podcast at this point about just different practical application of shamanism, and that's at whyshamanismnow.com. That's the name of the radio show, and it actually airs live at 11 on Tuesdays, and all that information is at whyshamanismnow.com. My classes and my healing, signing up for long-distance healing, any of that kind of working with me as a practitioner or a teacher is at lastmaskcenter.org. And that's pretty much... Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. So you do offer classes and training for people, and you're based in Portland, Oregon.
I'm based in Portland, but most of the healing work that I do can be done long distance.
Okay. Okay. Great. And in terms of workshops and training, do you offer online courses or are they all in person down in Oregon?
Well, that's actually changing right now.
Okay.
At the moment, they're all in Oregon. And they're all at very, very different levels. There's a, you know, a basic training, and then there's like once a month for 9 months, and then there's a 4-year training, and then everything in between. And I'm even starting to do some professional development for peers.
Okay.
Well,
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, folks, just to let you know that my guest today was Christina Pratt, as you heard. She has two ways of contact. She has her radio show, whyshamanismnow.com, and the Last Mask Center, lastmaskcenter.org. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And Christina, thank you so much for being with me today. You've been listening to the Linda Christensen Show, and we're here every Tuesday night on Contact Talk Radio. And just to let you know, next week, my guest will be Maureen Edwardson to talk about her latest book, Your Magical Evolutionary Code Unleashed, The Science of Inner Resonance, which will be very fascinating. She's quite the energy worker and has really put together an amazing how-to manual for clearing out your energetic grid. So she'll be my guest next week. So thank you so much for joining me tonight. And again, thank you, Christina. I hope to have you all with me again next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Linda Christensen Show, Spiritual Explorations of the Human Journey. Tune in every Tuesday here on Contact Talk Radio at 6 p.m. Pacific to expand your mind and nurture your soul with Dr. Linda.